Chapter 120. And trust, one morning when I had done jingling about with my baskets of keys, as my beauty and I were walking round and round the garden, I happened to turn my eyes towards the house, and saw a long thin shadow going in which looked like Mr. Vholes. Ada had been telling me, only that morning, of her hopes that Richard might exhaust his ardor in the Chancery suit by being so very earnest in it. And therefore, not to damp my dear girl's spirits, I said nothing about Mr. Vholes' shadow. Presently came Charlie, lightly winding among the bushes and tripping along the paths, as rosy and pretty as one of Flora's attendants instead of my maid, saying, "Oh, if you please, miss, would you step and speak to Mr. Jarndyce?" It was one of Charlie's peculiarities that whenever she was charged with a message, she always began to deliver it as soon as she beheld, at any distance, the person for whom it was intended. Therefore I saw Charlie asking me in her usual form of words to step and speak to Mr. Jarndyce long before I heard her. And when I did hear her, she had said it so often that she was out of breath. I told Ada I would make haste back, and inquired of Charlie as we went in, whether there was not a gentleman with Mr. Jarndyce. To which Charlie, whose grammar, I confess to my shame, never did any credit to my educational powers, replied, "Yes, miss. Him as come down in the country with Mr. Richard." A more complete contrast than my guardian and Mr. Vholes I suppose there could not be. I found them looking at one another across a table, the one so open, and the other so close, the one so broad and upright and the other so narrow and stooping, the one giving out what he had to say in such a rich ringing voice, and the other keeping it in such a cold-blooded, gasping, fish-like manner, that I thought I never had seen two people so unmatched. "You know Mr. Vholes, my dear," said my guardian. Not with the greatest urbanity, I must say. Mr. Vholes rose, gloved and buttoned up as usual, and seated himself again, just as he had seated himself beside Richard in the gig. Not having Richard to look at, he looked straight before him. "Mr. Vholes," said my guardian, eyeing his black figure as if he were a bird of ill omen, "has brought an ugly report of our most unfortunate Rick." Laying a marked emphasis on "most unfortunate," as if the words were rather descriptive of his connection with Mr. Vholes. I sat down between them. Mr. Vholes remained immovable, except that he secretly picked at one of the red pimples on his yellow face with his black glove. "And as Rick and you are happily good friends, I should like to know," said my guardian, "what you think, my dear. Would you be so good as to speak up, Mr. Vholes?" "Doing anything but that," Mr. Vholes observed. "I have been saying that I have reason to know, Miss Summerson, as Mr. C.S. professional advisor, that Mr. C.S. circumstances are at the present moment in an embarrassed state. Not so much in point of amount as owing to the peculiar and pressing nature of liabilities Mr. C. has incurred, and the means he has of liquidating or meeting the same. I have staved off many little matters for Mr. C., but there is a limit to staving off, and we have reached it. I have made some advances out of pocket to accommodate these unpleasantnesses, but I necessarily look to being repaid, for I do not pretend to be a man of capital, and I have a father to support in the Vale of Taunton, besides striving to realize some little independence for three dear girls at home. My apprehension is, Mr. C.S. circumstances being such, lest it should end in his obtaining leave to part with his commission, which at all events is desirable to be made known to his connections." Mr. Vholes, who had looked at me while speaking, here emerged into the silence he could hardly be said to have broken, so stifled was his tone, and looked before him again. "Imagine the poor fellow without even his present resource," said my guardian to me. "Yet what can I do? You know him, Esther. He would never accept of help from me now. To offer it or hint at it would be to drive him to an extremity, if nothing else did." Mr. Vholes hereupon addressed me again. "What Mr. Jarndyce remarks, miss, is no doubt the case, and is the difficulty. I do not see that anything is to be done. I do not say that anything is to be done. Far from it. I merely come down here under the seal of confidence, and mention it in order that everything may be openly carried on, and that it may not be said afterwards that everything was not openly carried on. My wish is that everything should be openly carried on. I desire to leave a good name behind me. If I consulted merely my own interests with Mr. C., I should not be here. So insurmountable, as you must well know, would be his objections. This is not a professional attendance. This can be charged to nobody. I have no interest in it except as a member of society, and a father and a son, said Mr. Voles, who had nearly forgotten that point. It appeared to us that Mr. Voles said neither more nor less than the truth in intimating that he sought to divide the responsibility, such as it was, of knowing Richard's situation. I could only suggest that I should go down to Deal, where Richard was then stationed, and see him, and try if it were possible to avert the worst. Without consulting Mr. Voles on this point, I took my guardian aside to propose it, while Mr. Voles gauntly stalked to the fire and warmed his funeral gloves. The fatigue of the journey formed an immediate objection on my guardian's part, but as I saw he had no other, and as I was only too happy to go, I got his consent. We had then merely to dispose of Mr. Voles. Well, sir, said Mr. Jarndyce, Miss Summerson will communicate with Mr. Carstone, and you can only hope that his position may be yet retrievable. You will allow me to order you lunch after your journey, sir. I thank you, Mr. Jarndyce, said Mr. Voles, putting out his long black sleeve to check the ringing of the bell, not any. I thank you, no, not a morsel. My digestion is much impaired, and I am but a poor knife and fork at any time. If I was to partake of solid food at this period of the day, I don't know what the consequences might be. Everything having been openly carried on, sir, I will now with your permission take my leave. And I would that you could take your leave, and we could all take our leave, Mr. Voles, returned my guardian bitterly, of a cause you know of. Mr. Voles, whose black dye was so deep from head to foot that it had quite steamed before the fire, diffusing a very unpleasant perfume, made a short one-sided inclination of his head from the neck and slowly shook it. We whose ambition it is to be looked upon in the light of respectable practitioners, sir, can but put our shoulders to the wheel. We do it, sir. At least, I do it myself. And I wish to think well of my professional brethren, one and all. You are sensible of an obligation, not to refer to me, miss, in communicating with Mr. C. I said I would be careful not to do it. Just so, miss. Good morning. Mr. Jarndyce, good morning, sir. Mr. Voles put his dead glove, which scarcely seemed to have any hand in it, on my fingers, and then on my guardian's fingers, and took his long thin shadow away. I thought of it on the outside of the coach, passing over all the sunny landscape between us and London, chilling the seed in the ground as it glided along. Of course it became necessary to tell Ada where I was going, and why I was going, and of course she was anxious and distressed. But she was too true to Richard to say anything but words of pity and words of excuse, and in a more loving spirit still, my dear devoted girl, she wrote him a long letter, of which I took charge. Charlie was to be my traveling companion, though I am sure I wanted none, and would willingly have left her at home. We all went to London that afternoon, and finding two places in the mail, secured them. At our usual bedtime, Charlie and I were rolling away seaward with the Kentish letters. It was a night's journey in those coach times, but we had the mail to ourselves, and did not find the night very tedious. It passed with me as I suppose it would with most people under such circumstances. At one while my journey looked hopeful, and at another hopeless. Now I thought I should do some good, and now I wondered how I could ever have supposed so. Now it seemed one of the most reasonable things in the world that I should have come, and now one of the most unreasonable. in what state I should find Richard, what I should say to him, and what he would say to me occupied my mind by turns with these two states of feeling, and the wheel seemed to play one tune, to which the burden of my guardian's letter set itself, over and over again all night. At last we came into the narrow streets of Deal, and very gloomy they were upon a raw misty morning. The long flat beach, with its little irregular houses, wooden and brick, and its litter of capstans, and great boats, and sheds, and bare upright poles with tackle and blocks, and loose gravelly waste places overgrown with grass and weeds, wore as dull an appearance as any place I ever saw. The sea was heaving under a thick white fog, and nothing else was moving but a few early rope makers, who, with the yarn twisted round their bodies, looked as if, tired of their present state of existence, they were spinning themselves into cordage. But when we got into a warm room in an excellent hotel and sat down, comfortably washed and dressed, to an early breakfast, for it was too late to think of going to bed, Deal began to look more cheerful. Our little room was like a ship's cabin, and that delighted Charlie very much. Then the fog began to rise like a curtain, and numbers of ships, that we had had no idea were near, appeared. I don't know how many sail the waiter told us were then lying in the Downs. Some of these vessels were of grand size. One was a large Indiaman just come home, and when the sun shone through the clouds, making silvery pools in the dark sea, the way in which these ships brightened, and shadowed, and changed, amid a bustle of boats pulling off from the shore to them, and from them to the shore, and a general life and motion in themselves, and everything around them, was most beautiful. The large Indiaman was our great attraction, because she had come into the Downs in the night. She was surrounded by boats, and we said how glad the people on board of her must be to come ashore. Charlie was curious, too, about the voyage, and about the heat in India, and the serpents and the tigers, and as she picked up such information much faster than grammar, I told her what I knew on those points. I told her, too, how people in such voyages were sometimes wrecked, and cast on rocks, where they were saved by the intrepidity and humanity of one man. And Charlie asking how that could be, I told her how we knew at home of such a case. I had thought of sending Richard a note saying I was there, but it seemed so much better to go to him without preparation. As he lived in barracks, I was a little doubtful whether this was feasible, but we went out to reconnoiter. Peeping in at the gate of the barrack yard, we found everything very quiet at that time in the morning, and I asked a sergeant standing on the guardhouse steps where he lived. He sent a man before to show me, who went up some bare stairs, and knocked with his knuckles at a door, and left us. "Now then," cried Richard from within. So I left Charlie in the little passage, and going on to the half-open door, said, "Can I come in, Richard? It's only Dom Durden." He was writing at a table, with a great confusion of clothes, tin cases, books, boots, brushes, and portmanteaus strewn all about the floor. He was only half-dressed in plain clothes, I observed, not in uniform, and his hair was unbrushed, and he looked as wild as his room. All this I saw, after he had heartily welcomed me, and I was seated near him, for he started upon hearing my voice, and caught me in his arms in a moment. "Dear Richard." He was ever the same to me. Down to poor, poor fellow. To the end, he never received me, but with something of his old merry boyish manner. "Good heaven, my dear little woman," said he, "how do you come here? Who could have thought of seeing you? Nothing the matter? Odd as well?" "Quite well. Lovelier than ever, Richard." "Ah," he said, leaning back in his chair. "My poor cousin. I was writing to you, Esther." So worn and haggard as he looked, even in the fullness of his handsome youth, leaning back in his chair and crushing the closely written sheet of paper in his hand. "Have you been at the trouble of writing all that, and am I not to read it after all?" I asked. "Oh, my dear," he returned with a hopeless gesture, "you may read it in the whole room. It is all over here." I mildly entreated him not to be despondent. I told him that I had heard by chance of his being in difficulty, and had come to consult with him what could best be done. Like you, Esther, but useless, and so not like you, said he with a melancholy smile. I am away on leave this day, should have been gone in another hour, and that is to smooth it over, for my selling out. Well, let bygones be bygones. So this calling follows the rest. I only want to have been in the church, to have made the round of all the professions. Richard, I urged, it is not so hopeless as that. Esther, he returned, it is indeed. I am just so near disgrace as that those who are put in authority over me, as the catechism goes, would far rather be without me than with me. And they are right. Apart from debts and duns and all such drawbacks, I am not fit even for this employment. I have no care, no mind, no heart, no soul, but for one thing. Why, if this bubble hadn't broken now, he said, tearing the letter he had written in two fragments and moodily casting them away, by driblets, how could I have gone abroad? I must have been ordered abroad, but how could I have gone? How could I, with my experience of that thing, trust even Vholes, unless I was at his back? I suppose he knew by my face what I was about to say, but he caught the hand I had laid upon his arm, and touched my own lips with it to prevent me from going on. No, Dom Durden. Two subjects I forbid must forbid. The first is John Jarndyce. The second, you know what? Call it madness, and I tell you I can't help it now, and can't be sane. But it is no such thing, it is the one object I have to pursue. It is a pity I ever was prevailed upon to turn out of my road for any other. It would be wisdom to abandon it now, after all the time, anxiety, and pains I have bestowed upon it. Oh, yes, true wisdom. It would be very agreeable to some people, but I never will. He was in that mood in which I thought it best not to increase his determination, if anything could increase it, by opposing him. I took out Ada's letter, and put it in his hand. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.